Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Judy Pierce, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic.
Thank you.
Glad to be with you all this morning. Want to thank the committee for getting me here, and also want to thank Karen. She has been such a wonderful hostess to me, and I appreciate it so much. You know, sometimes at these deals, you kind of feel abandoned. You know, you fly in, and they get you to the hotel, and then they kind of just drop you there, and you know, you're just like, I don't know, a stepchild at a family reunion, I guess, but you just, you know. So it's nice to feel welcomed, and I've been blessed in that I've gotten to see a lot of my friends that I haven't been able to see for a long time, and Diane being one of them, and we haven't seen each other for a good while, and God, it was good to hug her again, you know. Alcoholics Anonymous is a blessing, an absolute blessing, and I'm going to tell you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like today. And I don't change my format much. I wish I could be like some of the other speakers that I've heard, which, by the way, we've had some dynamite speakers here this weekend. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the Al-Anon speaker yesterday was incredible, just absolutely incredible. And if y'all don't go to the Al-Anon speaker meetings when you're at a conference, you're really shortchanging yourself. You really are. Because the beauty of this program working in Al-Anon is wonderful. And I'm here to tell you, I've had some Al-Anons help me out in my sobriety, too. You know? And very often people will assume that because I'm a woman, I'm an Al-Anon. And we clear that up right quick, okay? We don't. I was worried when I first started doing this. I had more guys come up to me and say, you know, I really could relate to you than I did women. But that was because I didn't clean my story up at all, and I haven't done it. I've been doing this a while, and I haven't cleaned it up yet. It was suggested to me once early on to clean up my story, and I thought about that. Because, you know, we learn here to be open-minded, right? So I thought about cleaning it up a little bit, and then I realized if I did that, I wouldn't have a story. So And I talk about my alcoholism, I talk about my active alcoholism, because, you know, really and truly, this whole thing is about the newcomer. And I want them to know that there was somebody who drank like they did, if in fact my story is like yours, and who came into Alcoholics Anonymous and never drank again. And I didn't. My sobriety date is December the 18th, 1972. And thank you. Thank you. And as one of my friends pointed out to me this morning, I was 3 years old when I got here. I wish. No, I don't wish. I like aging. It just gives you a whole set of challenges that you didn't think you'd ever have to look at when you're young and arrogant. So anyhow, I'm going to get right to the core of it so we can get to the getting well part of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay? I was raised in an alcoholic home. My stepfather was the alcoholic, and it was the typical alcoholic home. You never knew what was going to happen. You never knew when he was going to blow up. You never knew when he was going to be nice. You never knew when you just never knew. You never knew what was going to happen. My stepfather was also a violent man when he drank. And very abusive. And I was the oldest of three girls, and I took the brunt of that abuse. And not only was there the physical abuse and the verbal abuse, there was the sexual abuse. And that started when I was 9 years old, and it went on till I was 16. So I brought a pretty damaged package to Alcoholics Anonymous. And because I got knocked around a lot, and I never could pick up on the concept that my sisters did, which was, why don't you just be quiet? You know, I mean, they would just shut up, but I just knew I was going to straighten him out, you know, or I was going to say something that would make him see what he was doing. I knew that, so I wouldn't shut up until he hit me. And then sometimes I'd shut up, sometimes I was right back in there for more. And that's just the way it went. The abuse went, the sexual abuse happened as most sexual abuse happens. All right, they start you off with drinking. So that what inhibitions you have will go away. And that whole thing became a nightmare for me an absolute nightmare for me. Now, I'm telling you this for a couple of reasons. First of all, I don't see myself as a victim, although in fact I am, but I don't look at myself like that, because that to me is kind of a, I don't know, it's just kind of a wimpy word, and I don't like it. But nevertheless, if you are one of us and you this has happened to you, then do what you have to do to get well and get over that. Okay, they took your childhood from you. You had no choice in that. I am not one of those people who believe that you had a part in it if you were sexually abused as a child. I don't buy that. Okay, you were taken advantage of by someone who had a grandiose opinion of themselves and thought it was okay. Don't you accept any guilt on that crap. None. You had no choice. You were a child. Having said that, you go to your sponsor, you go to outside help if you need to, but get help with it. Don't let them take your adulthood too. They took your childhood. It's up to you. It's up to you to hold on to your adulthood. Don't let them ruin your life. And I found my answer in Alcoholics Anonymous by talking to strong sponsors and people who allowed me to share what I was really feeling. And most importantly, those people kept their mouth shut. And that's real important. I beseech any of you who are sponsors to remember that when somebody opens their life up to you in the fifth step, keep your mouth shut. This is not something you openly go out and share with other people within the program. Being a sponsor is a real serious responsibility. You're helping people get well in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we are saving souls, and we're saving asses in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what we do here. Now, some of folks have said I'm a little bit hard. And I am, and I make no apologies for that either. But I really, see, I was brought up by sponsors who said things, I would whine, rarely, but I would whine. And Jim was one of my first sponsors, and he would say to me, like with the fourth step, you need to do that fourth step. I don't want to do the fourth step. I'm not ready for the fourth step. Okay, fine, then get drunk. And that was pretty much the end of it. You know, there wasn't any of these long, drawn out, talking for 15 hours about what happened. There wasn't any of that. You know, it's just you do the damn program or you're going to get drunk. And, you know, we've gotten it to where it's so complicated anymore. Sometimes I don't recognize my own disease, for God's sake. Now, keep it simple, and that's what they told us. That is what they told us, to keep it simple. So anyway, I get out there, and of course, I got through high school. I didn't go to college because I thought it would interfere with my drinking, which kind of tells you where my thinking was. And that's essentially why I didn't go. I was so addicted to alcohol. And I knew early on my drinking was different than other people. I knew that. I could drink anybody under the table. I still have to laugh about it because, you know, guys would take you out and think, well, I'll get her drunk. And I would end up driving them home, you know. So just the capacity we have for alcohol is incredible. It is absolutely incredible. And I kept that up, that nonsense up until I got out of high school. And then I went to work right away, and I had a decent little job and eventually moved out of that house. And got a place in Buckhead, which back in the late 60s, early 70s was quite a place to live. And even though I am part of the 60s generation, I do remember bits and pieces of it. So I was doing a lot of drinking then, and I had that good little retail job that was respectable and whatnot, but that just wasn't working out. And this is where things really got tough, because once I left home, I really didn't have to worry about anybody watching over me. You know, Mom had caught me drinking and stealing booze a couple of times, and the look on her face, and somebody mentioned it this weekend, that look of disappointment and disgust and pity that they look at you, and that look never goes away in your mind. It just never goes away, and you see it over and over again. And the only way you can cope with what you saw in their eyes is to drink again, because it's too painful. It's too painful to see anything else. And so you drink again, and it just keeps going. And, you know, as I drank more, and I used to fight a lot, fist fight. I wasn't Not verbally. I didn't have the patience for verbal fights. And I just... sit and talk about it. I don't have time for that. you know, we're alcoholics, right? We're busy people. And so I'd get in these barroom fights, and you know, and then I'd leave. I'd get myself in more messes, and I just didn't know how that happened, because you know how it is. You don't intend to do that. You don't intend to do that when you go out. You don't intend to stir people up and get people mad. And I don't know what would happen. I just never knew what would happen. You know, and because I was violent, and I was violent. It wasn't just that I got a little mad. I was violent. You know, when I went after you, I went after you to end it, man. I didn't go after you just to hurt you. You know, and so it was nasty. I also had this other problem, which some people, some women may be able to identify with. I was addicted to men. I absolutely love them. There was a song that came out years ago, and it used to say, big, little, short, tall, wish I could have loved them all. And that was... Isn't that awful? So anyway, and you know, men can complicate your life, ladies. I'm telling you, you know, they can complicate your life. And I got myself in a real pinch one time because I got engaged to two guys at once. Which wouldn't have been bad if I could have kept up, but it's hard to keep up when you stay drunk a lot, right? So I had both of them over to the house, invited both of them over to the house the same night for dinner. So one got there, and I was sitting there, and we fixed a drink, and I was going. I was in the kitchen, and I heard the doorbell ring, and I went up to the door, and there's the other one. And I said, oh, come on in, you know. And all this time I'm thinking, what the hell am I going to do? And so I introduced him, and I said, y'all, excuse me, I got to go back in the kitchen. And the kitchen had a back door. And I just kind of took off and let the two of them work it out, you know. We function well under pressure. And I'm grateful to God I got the opportunity to make amends to one of those men after I was sober about a year and a half, 2 years maybe. And I was so grateful because, you know, and I make fun of that, but it wasn't funny because I was engaged to both of them, and that's just not a nice thing to do. And I was grateful that I had that opportunity to say to him, I'm sorry, and apologize for my behavior and for the fact that I thought so little of his feelings and his caring for me. Because we do have those good people in our life that come to us, that do try to help us, that do love us, you know, and we just use them up. We just use them up, and that's the way I was. It was just getting bad. I couldn't hold on to a job. I left that good little job and went into bartending, which is really where I needed to go, right? And started tending bar and working as a cocktail waitress and making really some good money because I've worked in some of the better houses in Atlanta as far as restaurants. I worked, I don't know if they do that now, but they used to call it what house you're working at, and that was referring to the restaurant. And I went to work with those, and I was working, like I say, at some good ones, but then things got bad, and my problem with drinking and my problem with my temperament got worse. And it was difficult for me to hold a job, and every time I had to take another job, I had to go one rung down until I was working at some of the roughest places in Atlanta. And they didn't even pay you. You worked for tips, and you worked when you showed up, you know. And I worked in those kind of places where there were a lot of fights going on. And I can remember literally carrying a tray through that bar to go to a back table and ducking so that I wouldn't get hit with a beer bottle that somebody was in a fight, you know. And it was just that kind of place. And sicker, too. See, I was only 22 now by the time this was going on, but I'm drinking so much that I'm sick all the time. I'm really skinny. I weighed about 85 pounds then. And sometimes now I long for those days. But it was just a horrible, horrible way of life. And I couldn't show up for work a lot of times. And the long and the short of that is I ended up going to work as a whore on the streets of Atlanta because that's what I had to do. And that's where alcohol took me. And I didn't stay there long because even in that profession, you got to be able to walk, and I wasn't doing real good with that most days. And so that's where I went. And I'll tell you the God's truth, and I think it's kind of sad, actually, and I think it's mostly hypocritical, that I can bring that up in some AA groups, and I'll get that look of disdain from people. And sometimes men and sometimes women. Like, how could you possibly do that? Real easy. I needed a drink. That's really, I mean, what are you questioning there, for God's sake? You know? And then I challenge them at the same point. Because I want to know how many of you didn't prostitute yourself in some way to get whatever your drug of choice was. How many times did you go against that which you knew was right and what you should do in order to have the money to drink or use? You know, and if you got a clean slate there, then I suppose you can stand in judgment. No. I've even had some people say maybe I shouldn't bring it up. I've even had some people say that a woman in AA, someone like me, should not be allowed to speak from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see how much I paid attention to that. Don't get mad at me because you didn't have sense enough to sell it, baby. This is the Sunday morning spiritual meeting. God save us. But people, you know how, really and truly, you know, it all catches up with you. It doesn't matter. It all catches up with you. And, you know, you can see it from the other people around. And one of the stories that I remember, and I always bring it up because it reminds me how bad it got. I was out with a guy, and nothing new, and we drove up to his sister's house, and she came running out to the car, and she ran over to my side of the car, and she said, "Don't get out of that car. I don't want my children to see a woman like you. You stay in that car." And I just remember that the bitterness that she said it with, and it pierced me to the core. Absolutely pierced me to the core. I don't want my children to see a woman like you. And I wanted to step out of that car and say, "Lady, I don't know what is wrong with me, and I don't know why I am the way I am, but I'm not going to hurt your kids. I'm not some kind of an animal. I'm not going to hurt your children." But I couldn't do it. I couldn't do that. And you know what I did? When she walked away, I reached underneath the seat of that car, and I got that bottle out, because that was the only thing that was going to give me relief to what that woman just said. And no matter how much I tried to forget those words, that's been, 43 years now, I still remember the look on that woman's face. Just total disgust. Total. You know, and that's the thing, and I appreciate so much what the Al-Anon said when she understood that we don't want to be what we are. It's just that till we get here, we don't have a choice. We just don't have a choice. I didn't want to be what I was. I was raised in the good side of town, and we didn't grow up to be hookers. I mean, that's just not what happened. That's not the way it was supposed to be. And you sit there in those brief, sober moments, and you say, "How in the hell did this happen? This is not where I wanted to go in life. How did this happen?" And then, more frighteningly, how am I going to quit? How am I going to get out of where I am? How do I get out of this hell that I'm in? And you don't know. And it is it's the hopelessness. It is all-encompassing. It grabs your heart. It grabs your soul. And it is just hopeless. And the only relief I had was to drink again. And so I did. And I attempted suicide. And I was at my mother's house once again. Have to bounce home, stay with Mama. She had divorced my stepfather by then, and so I went back home and just couldn't cope, and it was around Thanksgiving that I tried to take my own life, and she had to rush me to the hospital, and it was my kid sister that found me, and it was just a chaotic mess. And they pumped my stomach or made me get sick. They made me get sick. And, the next day, my mother threw me out, and, you know, I didn't realize how much love that took for her to do that. But she had been putting up with my shenanigans for years. And for her to look at me and say, "I have had it with you, and I've had it with your behavior, and you get out of my house. You are no longer welcome here. And, of course, I'm the alcoholic, right? So I'm, you know, the best defense is a good offense, and I very often was as offensive as I could be, and I was with her. You know, I told her, how could you do this? I mean, I'm your firstborn daughter. She wasn't buying any of it, man. I was out of there. And I went to stay with my cousin Joanne, and I wasn't with her but about 3 weeks. And she says, you know, you got to go. Been around a lot of drinkers, dude. No, I've never seen anybody drink like you. I never know what you're going to do. I don't know if you're going to burn the place down before I get home, because I was a chronic smoker then. And she said, and I come home, and you got some guys here. You can't even give me their first name. You know, well, that's the life of the alcoholic, right? And so she said, you need to go. Well, now, this was December, and it was cold, and I didn't have any place to go. I stood there at that door, and I looked out, and I thought, you know, there's not a soul on earth that I could go spend the night with. There was nobody that would take me in. I had burned up every relationship, used up every person in my life, and nobody wanted anything to do with me, and I don't blame them. I didn't really want anything to do with me. I just didn't have any choice, you know. And so I asked my cousin if she would call AA, and I asked her because the shakes were setting in, and I knew better than try and dial a phone. Back then we had those rotary dials, and you couldn't do it with the shakes. It wasn't going to happen. So she called him, and I took a drink around noon that day, and I went to that meeting that night, and that was a week before Christmas in 72. And they used to do 12-step calls back then. That's how, you know, people come and get you and take you to your first meeting. And there, a man and a woman came, a 12-step me, and took me to my first meeting. And during the course of that meeting, towards the end, I remember the laughter, just like I heard from y'all today. I remember the laughter. And I remember Buddy, the man that came to 12-step me, asked me towards the end of the meeting. He said, Judy, do you have any questions? Is there anything you want to know about us? And I said, no, I don't have any questions. I just don't want to be drunk anymore. I am sick to death of being drunk. And he reached over, I can still see him, he reached over that table and he patted my hand very lovingly. And he made me a promise. And he said, you don't ever have to drink again. And we're going to show you how. We're going to show you how. And, you know, that was a good promise. I've never had a drink again. Never. I was going to a nice group on north side of Atlanta, Sandy Springs, because that's where I had lived. That's where my mom lived. But I didn't fit into Sandy Springs anymore, and I didn't fit into a nice group anymore because my mouth had gotten horrible while I was out there, and my mode of dress was just exactly what you would think it would be, you know, green satin hot pants and fishnet hose and white vinyl go-go boots. Yes, indeed. Yeah. God, those things were ugly. You look back now, weren't they awful? And so I was still talking that trash, and I just didn't feel comfortable in that group. And I want to make it clear, it had nothing to do with the group. It had absolutely nothing to do with the group. They were loving, they were kind, they were welcoming. I didn't feel right there. I just didn't feel right. So one of the ladies very kindly came up to me and suggested that I go to another group. Maybe that I might feel a little better there. And so I went to the Atlanta Biscayne. I went to Biscayne when we were on Dresden Drive. And there were a lot of street people that went to Biscayne. There were a lot of folks there, God love them, used to take a bus from downtown Atlanta to come out to the Biscayne room for a meeting. We had one guy there, Carlton B. His nickname, street name, was Bull. And we, Bull, every night, took the bus out to that meeting. And matter of fact, he never did buy a car, because once he started getting sober and hung around a while, somebody always took him home, so there really wasn't any need. But he was a guy, some of you that are familiar with Atlanta and old Atlanta might remember the old Crescent House that was downtown Atlanta, right on Peachtree and 14th, I think it was. It was an old, rundown, ramshackle hotel, and a lot of the street drunks used to go in there and try and sober up. And it was just a flop house is what it was, but that's where Bull lived for the first 2 years of his sobriety, and he didn't drink. And there were a lot of people there that were like me, that had the foul mouth and the tight clothes, and we didn't know how to behave, but we loved one another, you know. And we loved one another because nobody else loved us, and that's really what it was. We clung to each other because our families had let us go. Our families had given us up, you know. And so we became family with one another, and we fed one another. If one of us was broke, we'd go out and buy Brunswick stew, and we'd buy a pack of cigarettes and divvy it up, because that's kind of how it was. That's what you had to do. Now, and in my own way, I miss those days. I know, because we were so tight. We were so tight. And a lot of them have passed on now, and I'm very happy to say to you that a lot of them passed on sober. You know, and I think that they stayed sober because we had gone as far as we could go, and we knew that. And we knew truly that for us to return to drink was to die. We knew that. You know, I knew when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if I told you or not, but I did 6 months in a mental hospital because I was a danger to society. And so they put me in a hospital, and they filled me up with pills and hoped that that would work, and it really didn't. It took me a little longer to throw a punch, but past that, it didn't do much of anything. If you've ever been on Miller Roll, everything goes into slow-mo. And anyhow, so I got in there, and I had my first sponsors, and I know a lot of people don't agree with this, but it worked for me. My first sponsors were men. I had two men that sponsored me, and I don't know if I was too much for just one, but I had two. And one of them had 8 years sobriety, and one of them had 12 years sobriety. And those sweet, loving men literally showed me how to stay sober. And I am forever grateful to them that their only motive in helping me was to stay sober. That's all that they wanted, was for me to stay sober. And they taught me how to live. And a lot of us, when we're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you come in with the attitude I came in with, I didn't do much talking. I just sat there and I watched you, and I watched you. You're really doing what you say you're doing. And that, I don't know, some people call that street smarts. I don't know that it's street smarts for me. It just, I didn't trust you, and I wanted to make sure that what you said you did, you did. You know. And I remember looking at Jim one time when he was talking to his wife, and the love that he spoke to her with, and the gentleness and the kindness. And I remember watching Jim when he was working with the new one, you know. And back then, sponsors weren't delicate with you, you know. They just weren't. And they told you like it was. And, you know, by God, you want to drink, you go ahead, but you might die. And don't count on me to welcome you back. You know, this is serious stuff here. We're not playing any games here. And so, and I miss that. And by the way, if I sponsor folks, that's pretty much the way it is. You know, your sobriety is your responsibility, not mine. I'll sponsor you, and I'll give you what I have to give you, but it's up to you to do the work. I am not a counselor. I don't get paid for what I'm doing. So, you know, if you fire me, it's your loss, baby. I'm serious. I mean, you know, we model cuddle these people, and alcoholics are alcoholics. We're master manipulators, all of us, master manipulators. Break our hearts, you know, and we've all got the saddest story. You know, but the truth of the matter is, when you get sober, part of honesty is cutting through the BS. It really is. Just let's get down to what the real issue is here. You know, and we have lied to ourselves for so long that we buy it. And a good sponsor is going to look you right in the eye and say, you're lying. They're not going to say, well, now, let's reexamine that. Well, now, let's see what your inner child feels about that. I am so glad, you know, and for the first 3 months I was in this program, I thought if I didn't behave, y'all would throw me out. Honest to God, I thought if I do something wrong, or if you found out, you would throw me out of here. You wouldn't want me to be part of you anymore. Now, there is a tradition that directly speaks to fallen women. Okay? And they also talk about prisoners, queers, fallen women. I can't remember all of them, which is odd because it's one of my favorite paragraphs. Wonder why that is. And but it tells us that we can't do that. We can't say to people, you can't come in. It also tells us in our promises, our darkest days are our greatest asset. You know, and I wish I could tell you how many times I've spoken from the podium to find out that some little gal is sitting out there waiting to hear my story, because she hasn't heard her story. And her story and my story are the same. I was 6.5 years sober, people, before I heard a woman stand behind this podium and say that she had worked as a whore. 6.5 years. There is no excuse for that. I know that she and I aren't the only two hookers that ever ended up in the limp. All right? I mean, really and truly, and if you hear nothing else I say this morning, if you hear nothing else, hear this well. Hear this well. Please, whatever you do, do not forget where you came from. Do not forget where alcohol led you. Don't forget it, because you are doomed to return. And don't clean up your story so well that you forget. You know, we've all got our nightmares. We've all got our skeletons. This is not my fifth step. Trust me, it is not my fifth step. Okay? But it needs to be said. And sometimes I go in and I listen to a meeting and I'm thinking, where did you people drink? You know, what did you do? Because, you know, again, go back to those days when you first came in. You know, when you're still shaken, you can't make a decision. You're scared half to death. You don't know what these people are going to do. You know, give them that hope that they too can get well. And let me tell you, my sponsors used to ask me that, and I wish sponsors would do it more. My sponsors didn't say, well, do you want to stay in recovery? They said, when do you want to get well? The very question implies that someday I will. Does it not? It does. The very question of when do you want to get well? Does it mean I'm cured? Absolutely not. But I can get well in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can recover. I am a recovered alcoholic. Now, you know how we are when people start these arguments over words, right? Where do we go? We go to the dictionary. I found my perfect answer to what recovery. When you are recovered, you are brought back into balance. And my life is balanced. My life is balanced today. You know, I haven't hit anybody in 33 years. Thank you. Thank you. I think we ought to have chips for that or something. You know, that was a big deal to me. And I can remember I was going to get in a fight one day, and I was at the club room, and one of my sponsors, Dad, was there, and Dad was a little tiny, just a wiry little guy, ex-merchant marine. Oh, tough as nails. If I ever started fighting again, I'd want him on my side. But I was walked in one day, and I was really mad at this woman because she was gossiping and just yada, 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 and I'd had it. And so I was walking back to approach her and tell her we need to go outside and talk, and Dad took one look at me and knew exactly what I was thinking. He knew exactly, because Dad used to fight a lot too, so we, you know, common ground kind of thing. And Dad says, where are you going, Judy? I said, I'm going to go back here and talk to her. We need to go outside and get this straight. He said, get you a cup of coffee and sit down. And I detected in his voice it wasn't optional. And so I got my cup of coffee and I sat down. And I still can see him in my mind's eye. He took that little finger of his and he poked it right here. And he said, let me tell you, girl, hitting people is not acceptable behavior. And then he gave me a gift that I've carried for many years. He said, you can't stay sober if you live like a drunk. And you get those moments when they throw cold water in your face, and that's where that one was. It was just that I'm living like a drunk and I'm trying to stay sober. And things started changing. And I'm not clear thinking for alcoholics, but I decided one of the things I needed to do if I was going to straighten up and be a sober woman and live right was I needed to get married. That's what I needed to do. So at 3 months sobriety, I found a husband, one of the easiest things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Easier than any of the steps, I can tell you that. And my husband had 4 months, so there you go. Oh, you think it's funny in the past. You should have been there. It was a riot. And I'm going to tell you something. that marriage just never should have been, all right? It just never should have been. It lasted 2.5 years. I will not say anything bad about him, and bless his heart, he's passed on now, but there wasn't any reason for that marriage to begin with. There just simply wasn't. But clear alcoholic thinking, right? You know, this is what we'll do. This will fix it. This will fix me. Well, it didn't fix me. And so we had lived in Hiawassee. I moved up to Hiawassee, and that was something else, too, because I was still like 24 years old, and there's nothing to do in Hiawassee. And I'm a city girl, and there's nothing to do in Hiawassee. And I nearly went nuts. Now, there is now. It's certainly much more of a town than what it was back then. But so I got into the literature of Alcoholics Anonymous. The meetings weren't in abundance up there. And so I read a lot of the books. And one of the books that I really dove into was Came to Believe, because, you see, I didn't have any relationship with God. I didn't have a bad relationship with God or a good, I had no relationship with God. He was just kind of out there, and that was it. And even at that time, and back then, they didn't push you to hurry up and take the steps. You know, my sponsors told me after I got a couple of years that first year, all they wanted me to do was not drink and keep going to meetings. Just don't drink and keep going to meetings, and I think that was divinely inspired. I don't know that I could have handled anything else. So I got into that book, Came to Believe. And I read it, and I reread it, and I reread it. And then the time came when the marriage was really getting bad, and it was the first time I ever felt real, real pain, you know, and with no anesthetic at all. It was just real pain. And I remember I sat next to a lake up there. We had an 8-acre lake not too far, and we were so broke. And I caught a lot of fish out of that lake to feed us, truthfully. And I was sitting there next to the lake, and I had the dogs next to me. I always had some kind of animal. And I had two dogs with me, and they were sitting down next to me, just peaceful and quiet, and I was crying. And I was sobbing, crying. And I told God, you know, first prayer that I remember making, and other than God, please help me when I got sober. But on that day, I remember saying, God, I don't know if you're up there, and I don't know if you can hear me, but I got to have some relief or I'll drink again. And I don't want to drink again. I really don't want to drink again. And it's not like God came down and said, okay, Judy, you need to do this and this and this and this. But there was a stillness in the air and a peace and a quiet that came over me that told me I was a child of God and that he heard me. And I absolutely know that happened. I know he heard me. And I knew from that moment, I didn't know exactly what to do, but I did know I was going to be okay. And I don't know where that, you know, you just don't know where that comes from. And if you hadn't had it yet, I can't describe it to you. But it's just that peace that comes in and says, no matter what, kid, you're going to be all right. You're going to be all right. And so shortly thereafter, I came back to Atlanta and I got a divorce. And shortly thereafter, like less than 30 days, I was hooked up with another guy. And I had known him. Did you all really expect anything different? I mean, I'm only 2.5 years sober now. And besides, you know, there's one thing that, and I hear a lot of it about, let me just put it this way. AA is not necessarily a vow of celibacy, okay? I mean, you know, you got a 23, 24-year-old woman and a very good-looking 32-year-old man. Now, what do you really think is going to happen? You know, you can't deny Mother Nature. That's my feeling. So, anyway, but I had known Craig. I had known Craig a couple of years before I divorced Ronnie. And the neat thing about our relationship is Craig was probably one of the first male friends I had. Because despite the fact that I didn't like my first husband, I was always faithful to him. That was a big thing with me. Big, big thing. And I know where that comes from, and so do you. I just did not want to put anybody else what I'd put some of those guys through. And I was going to be faithful. That was a promise that I made. And besides that, I took a vow, right? And I wanted to start living sober. And so I did that, you know. And so anyway, Craig and I got together, and we lived together for a year. And then we got married, and we had a wedding and the whole deal. And we started going forward with life. Now, he, of course, was a member of this fellowship, and we both did very well. We started getting the good jobs and the responsible positions and started showing up on a regular basis. And it's amazing what will happen if you really do work when you get to work. And It was just incredible. I couldn't believe my life. And it wasn't about 3 years, and we bought a home, and then he got a new car, and then I got a new car, and it was just doing all this stuff. And all the time, we were in Alcoholics Anonymous. All the time, we remembered where all that came from. We never forgot. We had one of those homes when we used to go, there would be people at Biscayne that were drying out. And sometimes we didn't have a shower for them there or anything, so sometimes we'd just load up the car and we'd take the guys home, let them shower at the house and clean up, and, you know, I'd wash their clothes and then we'd feed them and just kind of give them a here's what sobriety is, you know, and let them take a deep breath before they had to go back out there and really start. And I'm grateful to God that I had that. But Craig and I never forgot where we got that house. We got that house from God and Alcoholics Anonymous, and we knew that. You know, and the only way we were going to keep it is to give it away, and we knew that. And so we had a little apartment downstairs when some of the folks in the program that fell on hard times, and that does happen, of course, and we'd let them stay with us. And I never gave them a free ride. They all knew they had to pay rent, and it wasn't any big deal, but they weren't going to slide. And they all knew they had 90 days to get their act together. And one of them didn't believe me. And she came home at the end of 90 days because she had been out having fun. And her suitcases were waiting for her on the carport with her things. And she said, "You aren't throwing me out, are you?" And I said, "Yeah, that's what I'm doing." And I always had to play the bad guy, right? Because Craig, he just couldn't do it. You know, he just, big burly fella, right? And he just didn't have the heart to do it. So I was the bad guy. And I said, "You've had 90 days. You have made no effort at all to find a job or do anything. You're not going to live off me the rest of your life. You are out of here." And she said, "But it's raining." And I said, "And? Doesn't matter." Now, I tell you that story not to show you how tough I am, but I tell you that story because here's what happened to that young lady. She got so mad at me for being so mean, she went and found a job the next week. Let me tell you what else she did just to spite me. 2 years later, she bought her own condo. Just to spite me. That's okay, baby. You spite me all you want, man. Long as it's uphill, I don't care. To this day, and I sponsor her, and to this day, she still brings that up. Because she had been so institutionalized and so many people in her life had coddled her and told her, "You will never be able to function again in life. You know, you're going to need constant therapy," and on and on and on, that she bought it. She bought it. But she was a smart gal, and she knew what she was doing. She had a good brain. There's no reason in the world she had to be dependent on anybody. She was shortchanging herself, and she was shortchanging herself out of a lot of life. And so we had a good life. Craig's mother got sick, and things were not going well for us in Atlanta. We had just, it was in, there was another recession going on, and I had lost my job, and Craig had had some health issues, and he lost his job, and that was back when, you know, they wouldn't tell you they were firing you because you were running insurance up too high, but that's exactly what they were doing. And so we decided to make a move to Ohio, and we moved up there to Ohio, and I got into AA up there, and as Craig did, we started a group and just did what we knew to do. You know, those were the things you do. If you don't have a group close by, start one. So we did. And it was wonderful. And I loved being up there. We bought an old farmhouse, people. It was 125 years old. And we decided we were going to refurbish that place. And, oh, my God, if you've ever done a project like that, you know, behind every wall, there's surprise, surprise. And there wasn't a level floor in that place. It was just incredible. And I loved that house. It was a big old two-story farmhouse. And I just loved it. And we had a ball trying to fix it up. And Craig's health just kept getting worse. And we were coping as best as we could, you know. And then the day finally came when it just was not, there was no turning around. And I had taken him to the hospital. It was our 13th trip that year. And it was only May. I take it in the hospital, and the doctor had called. I wasn't home when I got home. I called him back, and he said, "Well, Miss Pierce, I don't know how else to say this, but we're not going to be able to do anything for him this time. He's probably not going to make it home." And Of course, the tears started flowing right away. And I hung up the phone and I thanked him for his honesty and for telling me the truth. And my next call was to one of my sponsorees up there. And I said, Craig's not coming home. And can you all get over here right away? And they did. And that was in 2001, and I still cry because I still miss him. And she came over there, and, you know, people were talking about allowing yourself to be who you are, even if you are a sponsor. And I held on to that girl and cried till I thought I was going to fall to my knees. It's one of the few times in my life where it took everything out of me. It just took it all out of me. And I didn't care if I was weak. I didn't care if I had to lean on you. I didn't care if you saw me cry. I didn't care. The pain was just unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. And I didn't know you could hurt that bad and still breathe. No. And so anyhow, we had a wonderful ceremony for Craig. And here's the joy and the beauty of this fellowship and these beautiful people. You know, the AA grapevine works really quick. You know, and so it wasn't any time at all before I was getting calls from Atlanta. And then my mama flew in, and family started coming up, and all these people that I hadn't seen in years. My cousin, who was with me when I got sober, drove from Michigan down to Ohio to be with me at this time. My sister, where there had been some real tight situations between she and I made amends, but it was 20 years before she and I ever got close. And she was there. Both my sisters were there, you know. And we did a lot of singing. We had an old-fashioned kind of funeral thing where we sang a lot. And my husband was in landscape and horticulture, and he was a tree surgeon. And we sang, you know, in the garden. And I cried the whole time, but I sang it, you know. And of course, any drunk's funeral wouldn't be complete without Amazing Grace, right? And then we went ahead and did How Great Thou Art, which is absolutely my favorite hymn. And it was absolutely one of the most loving things that I've ever experienced. And they didn't just come up and show up and then drop me. They continued to call and continued to make sure I was right. I was sharing with the ladies this morning that there was one guy I was in real estate then, and there was one fella that I had met. I had worked with his wife, and he and I just kind of hit it off. He's probably an alcoholic, but he was very kind. And every Sunday morning, I could count on Don to call me. He'd just call and he'd say, "How you doing? You need me to help you out with anything? How you doing?" And he did that for about 6 weeks after Craig passed, until he was sure I was going to be okay. Now, I share that because when I was out there drinking, and when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought these were the only folks that were going to help. But you know something? If you live right and you try and do right and you're good to people, everybody's there for you. You know, there are good people outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never knew that because I never looked. But, you know, I couldn't believe it. All the agents that I had worked with were there to support me. It was just phenomenal. We were in that little community, and neighbors that I had only met once or twice were at that funeral. You know, and I'm a big believer in be a part of your community. You know, I am absolutely an advocate for AA club rooms. I don't know what I would have done without that club room when I first got sober. That was my safe haven. That was the place I could run to and hide from the world. But then I started getting sober, and I wanted to start doing things. You know, our book talks to us about being part of a community, about doing things in our community. And it doesn't matter if it's a community you drank in or not. Give back. These people tolerated your behavior forever. Give back. You know, give back something. And I don't care what it is. If you want to get politically involved, I don't care. For me, it was a volunteer fire department. We had a little fair that we'd have twice a year, and I would help them out. My job was to slice pies. That's what I had to do for the volunteer fire department. And so I would, and I was a good pie slicer. But I loved it because I'm part of a community. I'm knowing my neighbors. I'm meeting them, and I'm accepted. They don't have to know my whole story. That's not relevant. The point is I'm accepted, and I didn't think that was ever going to happen. You know, so be a part of your community, and be a part of your AA community. Now, I got to talk a little bit about my other group, and then I'm going to shut up. I was a member of the Atlanta Biscayne Night Owls, and that was a conglomeration of folks that just, as our big book says, should not be together. Now, we were not real sane, albeit that we were sober, because we got together at 11 o'clock on Saturday night, and the bewitching hour for some of us, and it was a crazy bunch, and we had preachers in that group, and we had hookers in that group, and we had bank robbers, and we had bankers, and we had, you know, and never the twain shall meet met there. Okay, we met there. And I don't mind telling you that was one of the strongest groups in Atlanta for a long time. We were big believers in you contribute to the central office. We were big believers in, you know, you have plenty of literature for people to buy. We paid our dues. We did what Alcoholics Anonymous wants us to do. We contributed to our central office and the New York office, and we were a part of, and we were a strong group. And there might be a lot of stuff going on before that meeting, and a lot of filthy language, and a lot of stuff. But when it hit 11 o'clock, there's something that came over that group that was just like, okay, now it's time for a meeting. Now it's time. We bonded together. We were so close. We were so close. And I share that with you because I had the opportunity to go back down to the Atlanta Biscayne group recently and talk. And here's the neat thing about it. I was talking for two of my sponsorees. One of them was actually Craig's, and one was mine, and they both had 31 years. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know when they got so old, but they both had 31 years. Yeah, yeah. And see, that's the joy of Alcoholics Anonymous, you see, is that you get to watch that. You get to watch people grow up. One of these young ladies that I sponsored, I saw her when she came in at 17, and she was pregnant, and her husband. I saw both of them come in. I've also been able to watch the two children that they have grow up. I've also been able to see them become grandparents. How lucky am I to be a part of all of that? How lucky am I? And to see the love in their eyes when they see me. It's just unbelievable to me. See, that doesn't happen for women like me. Doesn't happen. Then there's another part of the story where I've had three people since I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous ask me if something were to happen to them, would I take their kids? That's a long way from where I came from. Now, that's a long way. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me tell you, I did not do my 40 years. All right? I didn't do that. God did that. God and Alcoholics Anonymous did that. I'm a big believer that if you've got 25 years, if you've got 30 years, if you've got 40 years, by God, don't be ashamed to tell it. Because you know what? Somebody sitting out there needs to know this is good for the long haul, man. You can do this deal for the long haul. You can die sober. You can die sober. That's what this is about. My mother, who threw me out of her home, we were out shopping one day. I'll never forget it. I was about 7, 8 years sober. And we were hitting the malls. And the car was quiet. We were going from one mall to another. And to spend money we didn't have. And she reaches over and she pats me on the shoulder. And she says, you're a good daughter, Judy. And you're a good person. And Mama loves you very much. And that just came out of nowhere, man. Just out of nowhere. And that, I believe, is Alcoholics Anonymous. That is working the program. That is making amends. My middle sister, Carol, and I, we're just two different people. We were just two different people. And it was a hard time. I made my amends to her, but that wound never seemed to heal. It just never seemed to heal. And I had resigned myself to the fact that if that's the way it was to be, that's the way it was to be. I did what my sponsors told me. I made my amends. I tried to be a good sister. You know. And a couple years ago, she was having some problems with her vision, and long and short of that is she went to the doctors, and she had a brain tumor. And it was a very serious brain tumor, and the location of it was very serious. And so we began that thing of going back and forth. And I would take off work, and Jackie, my other sister, would take off work, and we'd cart her back and forth because she couldn't drive. She simply could not drive. And we were going in for tests one day, and Jackie and I finally got her back to the condo where she lived with Mom. And she walked through that door, and Mom said, "How'd it go?" And Carolyn said, "Well, you know, it's a test." She said, "But I'll tell you one thing." She said, as a matter of fact, she said, "I'll tell you one damn thing." And Mom says, "What's that?" And she said, "I got the two best sisters in the world." And she had come up to my house after I moved in back to Georgia, and she would stay there. She was working at a hospital up there, and she would stay there, and she and I started talking, and we started getting close. And we started laughing like we once did a long time ago, you know. And we got to know one another and love one another again. And I was so grateful for that. Because, see, I had asked God, and I'm not a believer who says you don't ask God for anything for yourself. I do, because I need his help, and I do. And so I had asked God that if it be his will, to let my sister and I be sisters again. And I was allowed to do that before she passed away. She did not. She survived the surgery, but the infection set in. She was in ICU for 45 days and really never came out of the coma. But for 10 years, I had a sister because Alcoholics Anonymous. So you see, what I'm telling you here is you got no reason to drink. We got no reason to drink once we get to this blessed program. We have none. You'll get through it. And I'll tell you, you'll get through some of it not so gracefully. Sometimes you'll be awkward. You won't know what to do. Sometimes you'll make a fool of yourself. It's okay. Just don't drink. Just don't drink. Sometimes you'll take a stand in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I did once, and I felt like nobody agreed with me, but it didn't matter because I believed what I believed was right, and I still would. Given the same set of circumstances today, I'd take that same stand because you all gave me the courage to do that. I didn't have that kind of courage before. You know. And it doesn't matter what it was. It wasn't that important. But I took a stand and I stuck with it because it's what I believed. You know, I have been so blessed in Alcoholics Anonymous. So blessed. I am not the woman I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous because of you. I am not that woman. Praise God. Praise God. Thank you all very much.